when you think about love and community, because the more you're loved in a place, the more you want to be in that place. Many of you know that I had really stopped coming to Canada for a long while, not just because at the border they had stopped my books at one point, saying that, you know, I was pushing hate, but also because of the difficulty I had personally had at the border. And I noticed myself that since 9/11, I haven't traveled. Canada is as far as I've traveled out of the U.S. because I'm so hassled. And it's really made me aware of how forms of everyday terrorism that go undefined keep people in their place, keep people from speaking out. And I was thinking about that so much because I was thinking about what made me return to Toronto after many years of not coming here. And it really was the strength of the community of Black people here, that small community that I met years ago, that kept calling me back here, that kept saying, we value you, give us an opportunity to make amends, to be with you, to hold you in the embrace of our regard. So let me begin by thanking the Toronto Women's Bookstore and May for all the work that she has personally done interacting with me. It's hard to reach me, things change. I want to thank my sister for coming with me. Some of you may remember that I wasn't well the last time I came here, and normally May is a month of silence for me. I'm actually going to speak in a more irregular way rather than, because people ask me so many questions. And one of the questions, Andrew, who I also thank with my whole heart, Toronto Women's Bookstore again, was how do you get the courage to go on? And one of the things that I want to say is that courage comes from community. Courage comes from our ability to repair ourselves. The Kentucky poet Wendell Berry says, we hurt and are hurt, and we have each other for healing. So I thank all the people that made it possible for me to be here. Angela is my youngest sister of the six of us girls. And she's, of course, the spoiled one. And she came along to practice caretaking me. These are really grave times. And I was saying earlier, I was in conversation with Ronaldo, that I don't think it's any accident that many of the Black American people who have been heroic in their speaking about sexuality to us are dead. Audre Lorde, Pat Parker, yes. Essex Hempel, Marlon Riggs, I'm forgetting, Joe Beam. Many people don't even know Joe Beam's name, but he was one of the first Black men, Black gay men, to speak openly about Black gay male sexism, the homophobia of Black straight men, father-son relationships. And I think there's a tremendous link between stress, the individual stress, that people who dare to stand up and tell us things that other people won't tell us. June Jordan. You know, some days I open my address book and I see the numbers of all the Black women writers that have died in a short space of time. Or just walking in the bookstore today, I saw June's picture and her birth and her death, and you just think about what is the toll that it takes on the individual. I often think about Martin Luther King and his sex addiction. And I wonder about the toll it took on him emotionally to stand up and be the courageous person that he was. I mean, Martin Luther King was not a radical. I mean, imagine the toll that it took on this individual conservative Christian man to oppose the war in Vietnam. Remember when I was here last, I talked about the fact that King had been liked by everybody. You know, but suddenly he took this courageous stand to oppose war. And I think about the fact that we have models now like Farrakhan and, you know, Colin Powell, who are militaristic, who don't oppose war or imperialism, who simply want their piece of the dominator pie. And I think about us black people, how far we have come from Malcolm X, from Marcus Garvey, from Ida B. Wells, and Sojourner Truth, that our heroes can be these fascist people, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice. That they can come to stand for, you know, the very dominator things, imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist, patriarchy. And I want to tell you, they have community. Condi's sitting around talking about how much she just adores George Bush. And I want to say that to you, because as I talked with students of color and staff of color yesterday at the University of Toronto, we often find ourselves alone as dissenting voices on the left, as people of color, and as black people particularly, who take radical stands. We find ourselves alone. And that aloneness is detrimental to our health, to our psychological well-being. We need community. And one of the questions that people keep asking me is, aren't you worried that this focus on love and self and community is detrimental to real political struggle? You know, and I think about the Black Panther Party. Mumia has a new book on the Black Panther Party. And what annoyed me about it, because it's a really good book about the Black Panther Party's achievements, is he keeps trying to apologize for the sexism of the black male members of the Black Panther Party. He keeps trying to say it really wasn't that bad. It's like, why can't we say the Black Panther Party did incredible things, like the Breakfast for Kids, all of those things, but they were also really sexist and misogynist. It does not diminish the programs that they did for our benefit to also hold them accountable for the sexism and the misogyny. So that I really want us to think about that, because part of what seems to be fragmenting us so as communities of color especially, is we judge one another so harshly. You know, I think every day of my life, people of color in this room, we cut white people so much slack, it's unimaginable. You know, I mean, because we have become so numb to racism and racial assault that we actually go about our days and we've learned, you know, we just toss it off. You know, somebody white is really rude to us or nasty. We don't even deal with it. We just smile at them and say thank you, or, you know, and then we'll have a conflict with a person of color, or two black people will have a conflict. We won't speak to each other for 10 years. You know, we won't, you know, every time somebody says that person's name, we have our litany of their sins to pull out. You know, and some of you may remember that Michelle Wallace, about 10 years ago now, wrote this incredibly hateful critique of bell hooks. And my best friend at the time, I said to her, you know, I'm not going to read this, because it was published, and we're going to talk about Now, too. Many of you saw my image on the cover of Now. Wasn't it interesting, the headlines? Feminist hellraiser. What does it say, Joseph? Feminist hellraiser. Softer sell. And when I saw that, I felt assaulted in the core of my being. Because I think, what does this headline have to do with justice and freedom and liberation? And if I were Noam Chomsky coming to Toronto, or Howard Zinn, would it read, you know, leftist hellraiser, softer sell, or, you know, so that here again, the other hand, there would have been a time in Canadian history when Now would never have had, or any periodical here, a black person on the cover at all. So once again, we have to learn to hold two things. We can say, isn't it wonderful that they interviewed me and put me on the cover? Isn't it too bad that I had to be reconstructed under this racist way of seeing black women, which is, the girl used to be a bitch. And now, okay, let's do some deep and profound cultural criticism. Now she's not a bitch, she's just an opportunist. It's because softer sell? I mean, think about that. Feminist Hellraiser, softer sell. None of which speaks to any of the real primary ideas of my work, you know, which really has to do with dominator culture. I mean, we could think of all other kind of headlines, you know, that we could have written. I mean, I have my students write, let's write the different things that we could say and hear. Because again, I want you to think today with me about our collective spiritual crises. Because this stuff wounds us. I wasn't excited to see this image. It wounded me. It wounded me in that place where I am sick and tired of being represented by other people in ways that reflect imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy, even as I need those people to publicize my books, to publicize my talks. How do we live within the space of those contradictions? The only way we truly live well within the space of those contradictions is in the space of self-love and community. So that we must choose our community wisely. And many of you know that I talk all the time about I take my community where I find it, because I recognize how important it is to be in community for one's soul survival. If I think that there was anything militant black people resisting racism misunderstood as patriarchal ethos took over the 60s and 70s, was the for soul renewal. You know, Sojourner Truth and those black people trying to lead us out of slavery never thought for a minute that they didn't have to take care of their souls. You know, when she said, I cried out with a mother's grief and none but Jesus heard. One, she recognized that she had to cry out in grief. I'm sorry about the noise this is making. That she needed to cry out and she needed to have someone hear her cries. You know, I only hear from black women who say, I'm not alone as long as I have God. Because black women recognize that there are so many forces that militate against us living in community, even with one another. Because I want to go back to Michelle. Because one of the things that happened is I refused to read the piece that Michelle wrote about me. And I asked my best friend to read it, to tell me what she thought were the meaningful, if any, points, and what were the salient negative points. I got many calls at that point from other black women. You know, this is wrecking your career, girl. You need to read this, bell hooks. And I said, no, I heard this is very poisonous. And just as I would not eat poison that you were handing me, I will not take in this poison. And I have to ask, what is going on with my sister, Michelle Wallace, that she is writing this poison, so that I have to also be willing to step into the space of compassion. And I'm not trying to pretend I'm a saint. One of the reasons I didn't read it is that I knew that if I read it, my ego would have jumped all in it. And I would have been angry and bitter. And every time I heard her name, you know, I would have been able to come out with my bitterness and my rage. And you know what? I love Michelle Wallace's work. I think Invisibility Blues is a fantastic piece of cultural criticism. And I can stand before you and testify that had I read that poisonous critique, I would not be able to continue to hold my regard for her work, because my ego is just like everyone else's in this room. It's flawed, it's imperfect. And it was only by not taking that in that I was able to maintain the sisterhood and the feeling that I had for her work, you know, so that when she, in later years, would call me and tell me about that period of her life, a feeling that she was sinking into greater and greater isolation, because white people only allow there to be one. And she felt that Bell Hooks was the one, and that she had to eradicate Bell Hooks symbolically in order to restore her own visibility. How many times as women, I just finished reading Phyllis Chesler's book, Woman's Inhumanity to Woman, as people of color, do we feel we have to eradicate one another in order to restore our visibility? And of course it's flawed. She didn't restore her visibility. The white folks used her to create this spectacle of two black women hating one another symbolically, and then they dropped her. I mean, it's so deep and profound, isn't it? I mean, for when we talk about why is it important to deal with self and community? Because I don't think for a minute that we can be dysfunctional as individuals and create functional political movements. So that's one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about self and community, because too long our activism has been riddled through with dysfunction, with power struggles, with the desire for one person to topple another person. I want to be seen as the person who put that in place. So I think for all of us, this is the hour for us to attend to the restoration of our souls, because the forces of dominator culture, I can't tell you how intense they are in our everyday lives. As more and more black Americans move into poverty and addiction, as more and more black people die in wars, whose images we never see, whom no one really cares about, all the displaced, homeless black people in the grand United States of America that no one talks about, because we talk about Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. You know, Condoleezza Rice, who says, oh, war is like football. And if she could be anything, she'd like to be head of the NFL. I think that's obscene. And I think Colin Powell is a far more person of integrity, because he's not sitting around saying that war is like football, because he's been to war. And he's seen the devastation of war. But one of the things that's happening to people is people feel such despair in the United States. They feel that there's so little we can do to end dominator culture. And one of the reasons that I go back to the question of love and hope is it was Imam Mary Baraka who first said to me, and then publicly, that nihilism is not revolutionary, that we need hope. We need to believe in order to create our political movements, in order to strengthen community. We need to believe in the power of community even when our communities are failing us. Those of you in recovery know that you hear so often act as if. I think it's important for us to act as if in the process of community making, even if there are flaws in our struggle, because as long as we act as if, we keep alive our hope and our belief in community. I think that when you speak about love in relation to political movements and ending dominator culture, we're constantly working against the sentimental patriarchal notions of love and talking about love as that political force that energizes you, that gives you the courage, that allows you to go forward one more time. You know, I think I said when I was here before that I just love to hear Sweet Honey in the Rock, seeing when we work for freedom, we cannot rest until it's done. Because it constantly reminds me of going that extra step in relation to myself, in relation to someone else, in relation to people that I may not be interested in. Do I really want to take time with this white person to let them know something? Do I really want to take time, you know, with a bougie black woman that I think is dissing me? You know, one of the things I've been working a lot with is the idea of what does it mean to embrace difference in community? And again, if you don't have a core of self-love, difference will be threatening to you in community. Because making community with people that are different from you is not the same as making community with people who are like you. And black people, you know, we have lots of differences. Differences of nationality, language, perspective, religion. And white supremacy has impinged upon us so much that we don't spend enough time investigating our differences, talking about how we may work through some of those differences to come together. And I will tell you a difference that I've been really struggling with as a radical person on the left, a black person on the left, and that is the impediment, I believe, of fundamentalist Christianity. Mm-hmm. When I spoke with Rinaldo earlier today, I was saying to him that in terms of discourses of black sexuality, one of the most silencing forces in the United States is the force of fundamentalist Christianity. And I made a point of saying, not Christianity, fundamentalist Christianity that promotes homophobia, that promotes the control of women's bodies. I mean, I just went to a graduation ceremony for black students at a college, and the vast majority of the black females who were graduating were pregnant, not by their own choice, not by planning pregnancies. And I kept thinking, what is this about? And as I talk to these young women, they don't feel they can have abortions. Because fundamentalist Christianity is telling them, as my niece said to me, well, if you're big enough to do what it takes to get a baby, you should be big enough to have it. I mean, how sad is that, that that's as far as we can go in thinking about parenting, what parenting really means. Like, we're these brood sows. You know, just let us get pregnant, and if we, you know, because the underlying text is stupid enough. If you're stupid enough to do this, you should be stupid enough to have it. I mean, it's so riddled with the contempt of black womanhood. Many of the things that we're taught as black people from fundamentalist thinking are underlined with shame and contempt of our womanhood, and we don't unpack that. Just like this stuff about on the down low. One of the messages, and you've all heard it if you saw it on Oprah, and, you know, is that black women are so stupid once again. Black women are so stupid. Just tell them anything. They don't ask any questions. You know, just tell them that condom is too little for you. You know, and they're just so stupid. I mean, I think this, you have to ask yourself, as I raised yesterday, why is a racist, sexist mass media all of a sudden so obsessed with black people's sexuality on the down low? Whose interest does it serve? How much does it reproduce the idea of the black woman as someone who doesn't think? I don't know what's happening in Canada, but in the United States, black children are being taken away from black women every day on the basis that they're ill-equipped to raise their children. And you have to understand that if the media is pushing the image of black women as just stupid, thoughtless, how does this affect public policy? It's not innocent at a time where children are being taken away. You know, I just had a black woman professional lawyer tell me that her husband had become angry at their child, and he's a doctor, for getting a bad report card and had said to her, "I'm going to kill you if you don't do better," in his rage. The woman felt she had to go and seek legal, she had to report it to the police, the authorities, because if she did not, and her children went to their all-white school and started saying that their father had threatened to kill them, her children could be potentially taken away from her on the basis that she knew that they were endangered and did nothing. Now think about that in terms of imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy. Think about it in terms of black male-female relationships, because the state is watching. I mean, this is why I'm talking about fascism more and more, because the interference of the state in people's lives on all levels is happening every day in ways that people are not paying attention to. Every day in the United States, a black woman's child is being taken away from her for no reason. That is clear. And you can read Dorothy Roberts' book, I'm forgetting the name of it right now, where she documents this at great length. So when we talk about community, I was talking earlier about the movie Monsters Ball, and I was saying, we might have asked ourselves, why did Letitia have not a single friend? Why, when she's being put outside her house, there's no circle of black women who seek to help her. There's nobody who says, come in, honey. And we're talking about popular culture and the images that we receive in popular culture. This is the image of a black woman who is without community. Orlando Patterson, conservative spokesperson, anti-feminist, black historian, says, black men are some of the most isolated people in the United States. Black people, he says, are. We talk about community, but we don't really have community. That we have all of this rage and conflict. And many of us know that's not true because we have incredible community. But do we theorize about it? Do we talk about it? Do we share with other people how you make community? How do you attend to the self in community? I mean, just last month, I was in Detroit speaking to at a college that serves steel workers. And they are many black people and white people who worked in the steel mills in Indiana for 20 or 30 years. And the mills are closing. And through this college, they are allowed to come back to school and to get an education. And a black woman stood up there and she said, in the past 9 months, two of my children have been murdered by other young black men, executed, 16-year-old and 17-year-old. And she was saying to me, how, I don't feel that I have the will to go on. And what can you say to me that will help me get the will and the strength to go on in my life? And what I said to her is, let's begin to critique that notion of the will. Where is it coming from? Western metaphysical dualism, the idea of the individual. You know, you should be able as an individual to pull yourself up and transform yourself. Healing does not take place in isolation. I said to her, it's not a question of will. Perhaps it is a question of surrender into the arms of community. What is your community? What can that community do for you to uphold you at this moment of time when you cannot uphold yourself? And perhaps should not even be trying to uphold yourself through the strength of your will. How many of us are broken daily because we're trying to force ourselves to do something through the strength of our will? Because dominator culture has told us that the chosen people, the people who have a right to live on this earth, are the people who do things by the strength of their will. Do you realize how much the image of Native peoples have not changed in the United States? Do you realize how many white children are being taught daily that the Native peoples did not deserve to live because they didn't have the strength of will needed to slaughter white people as effectively as white people slaughtered them? I mean, we have to think about the Western metaphysical dualism that underlies the structures of domination that are taught to children daily. The strength of will, the idea that objectivity, disconnection. I mean, think about all the things that we are taught will lead us to success in dominator culture. And this is why I think many of us as people of color, and black people particularly, are going crazy right now. Because we have been told these are the things that will lead you into greater success. Individualism, you know, being willing to be competitive. And most importantly, the capacity to disassociate. So if you're sitting in that corporate boardroom and the white people you're sitting with are talking about niggers, you know, you're just supposed to smile and continue the meeting. You're not supposed to get angry, lose your mind, talk back, resist, because that proves you don't have the strength of will. You don't have the capacity to disassociate well enough to make it in our corporate world. I mean, so don't you think that this has so much to do with the crisis many of you in this room are in, that you've been educated to enter the structures of domination and make it? And in order to do that, how much disassociation do you have to do daily? And how do you go home and say, oh, I disassociated all day, but now I'm going to recover and return to my core self? You know, I mean, I keep hearing about all these young black people who don't want to work. You know, I sat last week with a young black woman, 20 years old, living with her dad, her biological dad, incest survivor of a stepfather, middle class parents, an addict, 15 and 16, OD two nights before her high school graduation. And she's sitting there and she's telling me, she's a beautiful young black woman. Well, I don't want to work. I just want to find me a rich man who'll take care of me. And I said, well, okay, tell us, how many women like yourself do you know that have a rich man who just takes care of them? She had one. And I said, okay, what is his job? Street pharmacist. In other words, you know. And I was saying to her, well, is that what you want for yourself? I mean, you come to recovery, but is what you want for yourself the rich drug dealer who can keep you with all these material things? And as we talked, she began to crumble in front of me. I mean, it was the most sad moment. You know, when you see a human being who's being grandiose in the way that Alice Miller talks about it, then flip over into, I'm nothing. I'm not worthy to be alive. I've been an addict. I don't have any money. I just have debts. I can't find any man to love me who doesn't betray me and violate me. Why should I be alive? I mean, that's the profound despair. Now, if this is the despair of a middle class, well-educated, private school educated, got her BMW when she graduated from high school, imagine the despair of her counterpart who has nothing but the fantasy of wealth, the lottery ticket. And I like it when Fran Lebowitz says, you have as much chance of winning the lottery if you don't buy a ticket as if you do buy it. You know? But imagine that whole structure of despair, because this is what we're in. I mean, it may sound like one individual, but it's widespread in our nation right now. And these are not children of resistance. These are children of dehumanization and capitulation to the status quo. You know, I don't remember the context yesterday when we were talking about a young black male teenager saying, yes, he's homophobic, but he's a mirror of the culture that he's in. It's not like, why should I critique and change it? Why can't you accept that I'm simply being as the culture wants me to be? So then when we talk about self and community, we really talk about what is needed to build communities of resistance. Communities where, because the right is a well-organized community. You know, one thing that struck me on the left is you go to all these left things, you can go right over tomorrow to the Spirit Matters conference, and you will see none of the diversity, the ethnic and racial diversity, in terms of Toronto. You know, we on the left will sit around for days and say, why can't we get some people of color to come to our meeting? And yet, you go to any evangelical Christian, you know, right-wing conference, and the black people, the Asian people, the Native people will be there, singing and joining hands. And I remember the black woman who said how sorry she was that she didn't die with the other Jim Jones people, because it was only in the context of that group that she felt for the first time that she was treated like a human being and not like a degraded person because of her skin color. I reflected on that. Why are we unable on the left to create the context of community that is welcoming? Why are we unable, you know, to risk opening up the spaces of our lives to include difference? And I see the part of the tension between self and community is you can't create the spaces of inclusion and keep everything the same. I think about my favorite women's bookstore in the United States, which is Karis in Atlanta, Georgia. It's one of the few bookstores that has opened itself to having people of color, feminist bookstores, lots of gay people, but how can we open our doors, they say, to welcome everybody? And what they realize is they had to begin to change. They had to have some people of color faces. They had to change some of their ideas about acceptable behavior. You know, we don't have to sit in bourgeois silence. It's okay to call out.
Yes.
You know, it's okay to have different kinds of arrangements. I mean, I think this is a really difficult thing. We can laugh about it, but when you want to build community, you have to be willing to change how you live in the world. I mean, the other day I did a group, and I was talking about the fact that we took time in the group to get to know one another, and it left us with not a lot of time to deal with our focus subject. And yet it was such a marvelous thing to hear people speak their truths about their lives, what they were doing. And we felt closer in community, but we were not able to focus as exclusively on our topic as people wanted. And so I urge you to think about how many structures in dominator culture are set up to militate against community, so that if we want to build community, we have to begin to talk about undoing those structures or being satisfied by less than what we hope for. I mean, one of the Buddha sayings that I meditate on daily often is, do not seek perfection in a changing world. Instead, perfect your love. Because let me say that again, because it's so, to me, profound. Do not seek perfection in a changing world. Instead, perfect your love. Okay, let me go back to me and Michelle. Seeking perfection would mean that I say, oh, that bitch has dissed me. You know, after I've been so good to her. I mean, I was at her wedding. You know, we hung out all the time. You know, I got to get back. And I come up with all my ways to get back because she was not perfect. What does it mean to cultivate compassion? You know, and I was so struck as you try to practice something, because one of the questions one of you asked me to answer was, what happens when you try to cultivate something against the grain? It felt so bad to have, everywhere I go, people were standing up in my talk saying, well, did you read the thing that Michelle Wallace wrote about you? And when I said, no, I didn't read that, I respect her work. Then what people said, well, Bell Hooks is so arrogant. You know, she thinks she's too good to even read, you know, a critique of her. And so you see those cycles of estrangement. And people love for black people to be estranged from one another, you know, and black women to be estranged from other black women. And when I kept simply saying, I really respect her work, and I didn't feel the need to read this piece, I felt that sense of I couldn't be alone. You know, the white people at the paper were asked, the cool paper like now, do you want to have a response? And I thought, you know, I'm not selling papers for you. You know, I'm not joining you on the plantation. You know? But all of that made me feel more alone until I began to find those people who could understand what I mean when I say, why do we take certain forms of poison into our system every day? And people of color, we live in these worlds of white supremacy. We can't go outside our houses without being assaulted by poisonous, toxic waste, both in the environments that we live in, I mean the real waste of environments, but psychological waste. You know, that when we look up on billboards and we see certain things, certain images, when we see magazines, our absence. When our children go to see the Peter Pans or the Harry Potters and our little black girls have no voice, no love, no attention, no presence, they are being assaulted in their selves and in their identities. How do we build community that can sustain us? I want to close by talking about this. I've been working on a children's book that I want to read to you called Skin Again, because I wanted to write a book for children that would deal with the question of race and that would acknowledge the value of race and racial identity while also acknowledging that we are always more than our race. And this is how it goes. It says, the skin I'm in is just a covering. It cannot tell my story. The skin I'm in is just a covering. If you want to know who I am, you have to come inside and open your heart way wide. The skin I'm in looks good to me. It will let you know one small way to trace my identity. But then again, the skin I'm in will always be just a covering. It cannot tell my story. If you want to know who I am, you've got to come inside. Be inside with the me of me, all made up of stories, sometimes true to life, and others all fun and fantasy, all the ways I imagine me. You can find all about me coming close and letting go of what you might think I am before you come inside and let me be real and you become real to me. All real there in that place where skin, again, is one small way to see me, but not real enough to be all the me of me or the you of you. For we are all inside, made up of real history, real dreams, and the stuff of all we hope for, when we can be all real together on the inside. Thank you. I call on my friends. I would like there to be people in this audience to stand up and say, where do you get the courage, your name, and what you do to get the courage to act on your behalf? Just a few of those voices of testimony. What do you do? Murphy. In the mirror sometimes too. Somebody else, somebody behind us, your name. And I'm sorry that my back was turned to you all most of the time, but it was because of space. Your name? Louisa. Community, that men in fact like isolation. And all of us collude in keeping alive that false consciousness about who men really are. And in that sense, many of us who say we're feminist and anti-patriarchal really continue to hold on to patriarchal notions of masculinity, which we impose on to men. I think, for example, the feminist studies that actually showed that 15 and 16 year old boys were not happy to be isolated and alienated and sitting in front of their computer, but that they simply felt that this is what the culture expects them to do as a rite of passage, to disconnect from parents and siblings, to no longer seek hugs and touch. And so we support them by saying, oh, well, that's how boys are. Oh, he's going through that stage. You know, all of those things. So partially, just think every day as you see men that this is a man who's longing for a community. You know, and think about bullshit like George Bush saying that he couldn't go to his daughter's graduation. I mean, that was such nonsense. You know, but it was interesting because I thought that, again, we have patriarchal, white supremacist patriarchy glamorizing its own disassociation and disconnection. I mean, isn't that deep? And I said, those daughters of his probably said, please don't come and spoil our graduation. You know? But we would never hear that. Because it would tell us something. I mean, read Michael Moore when he's writing about the fact that they asked him not to run for president because They feel it will be destructive to their emotional well-being, and he doesn't care. I mean, don't laugh at that, because isn't this the image of fatherhood that we uphold in patriarchal culture, that it's not the business of fathers to care for the emotional well-being of their children? So that if we have a nation with a man at the head of it who says he doesn't have the time or is willing to undergo the discomfort to attend to the emotional well-being of his children, what is that saying to fathers all over about the relationship that fathers should have with children? I think that it's very crucial that we challenge men in their patriarchy every single day that we can, because I think that patriarchy is killing men and cutting men off from themselves and other people. But I also think we need groups for men like AA, like NA. We need healing groups for men that are free, because there is nowhere for men without money to go who seek to transform patriarchal consciousness, who seek to learn new ways. And let me tell you this as an intellectual. Theory doesn't mean anything. It is totally meaningless if people don't have an active model of how to bring something into being. So if you have a man who has the theory that he would like to be anti-patriarchal, he would like to talk to his wife or his sister if he's gay, or his girlfriend if he's gay, differently, he may not know how to do that. Where do we model any kind of alternative masculinity for men? Where a man could, imagine if we had groups where men could go daily. I mean, those men that we're told hold their newborns only so many seconds a week, where they could go and talk about what they fear about having a newborn child. Your name? Can you hear her in the back?
No.
She's talking about overfunctioning black women. She was just telling us about her mother, who's worked hard all her life.
And I appreciated that my mother's worked hard, but I don't feel like I necessarily got to feel the bond of love. Like, I
absolutely.
My community, per se, with my own family. So how is it that we can reach these overfunctioning black women that don't have time to read books about love?
Well, I don't think, first of all, I think we have to stop saying that our mothers who overfunction don't have time, because they watch a lot of TV often. You know, they watch TV while they're ironing, while they're cooking. They could be playing a tape of a Bell Hooks book. They could. So, I mean, one of the things that I think we have to do is stop making excuses for the dysfunctional behavior of what we have traditionally talked about as strong black women. I mean, and here's an example from our mom, Angie. You know, the other night I called mom. She sounded like she was near death. She said she hasn't been feeling well. I mean, she actually said she felt that she needed to go to the emergency room, but she didn't want to go. And I said, well, what are you doing, Mom? Well, these clothes fell off, and I'm busy working. I said, Mom, you don't have to work. It's 8:30. Sit down. Who cares? You know? But, of course, she doesn't hear any of that because she is addicted to overfunctioning. She's addicted to being a martyr. And there are generations of black women that all we can do is have compassion for them, because they refuse to let in any window of possibility of restoration, of soul restoration. You know, and I think this is something we grieve, many of us as black women, because many of us who've made money and who'd like to relieve these overfunctioning martyr black mothers often find that they don't want relief. And think about the fact that many of them are psychologically wounded. And in the space of sitting down, you get to feel your pain. As long as you stay active, as long as you're raising, yet, you know, you're raising the daughter's daughter, daughter's daughter, and you've not let any time come in, you don't get to deal with your own pain. And I think that partially Black people, how many books do we have that honors our pain and tells us we have a right to deal with it? I mean, how many television shows give us an example of a Black person who's experiencing some traumatic pain dealing with it? I mean, when's the last time? I mean, one of the things that I liked about the Mother Blaming movie with Denzel Washington, Antoine Fisher. The good thing about Antoine Fisher was that we saw a Black man seeking therapeutic care for being in pain and acknowledging his rage. But in general, we don't see that at all. And I think that movies are very crucial in teaching people what is acceptable in our life. You know, what is allowed. And again, the problem with that movie is that you do the man thing at the expense of women. That the mother is blamed, the father is idealized and glamorized, where the mother is seen as the person who is the violent abuser. And not that that boy has been abandoned by both mother and father. I mean, so that it's a deep thing for us, because don't you think, Black people, that we're constantly, if we get a movie that shows us something progressive about race, it's usually Neanderthal when it comes to gender and sexuality. So that we're still being held slaves. I love the title of Scheherazade Ali's second book, Are You Still a Slave? Because I think, Black people, we can grow from asking ourselves that question, people of color, are you still a slave? As you look about your daily life, you had a question. You remember it after all this time?
Sure, I do, but it wasn't a question, actually. It was part of saying what gives us strength to continue. And there are two books that I urgently would like to share with the full auditorium.
Well, share your name first, and then we want to hear your two books. Okay, two books.
Right, two books are, one's called The Dark Side of the Light Chasers by Debbie Ford.
The Dark Side of the Light Chasers by Debbie Ford. I like that book too.
And I think it's useful because it will give white people the power to regain all the parts of themselves that they've been suppressing and killing. And the second part, the second book is called Splitting the Sky by John Bumford Hill, Jack Ajuaya, and it's about the struggle as a Native Aboriginal in Canada and the U.S. coming face to face with the authorities.
Splitting the Sky. Very hard to get, but you can get. I'm all in favor of Xeroxing things. Angela, you're... Angela's asking a question. Stand up, Angela, please. It's just hard to hear if you don't. Angela, that's a fantastic question. For those of you who couldn't hear her, she posed the question that as we're seeing all the violence, we're also seeing a burgeoning market in self-help books, many of which, really 99% of which, divorce self-help from any kind of political resistance. And this is why so many people are disturbed when a bell hooks or begins to talk about self-help, because people fear that we'll get into this kind of inner stuff that is not linked to political practice. But one, if you read bell hooks in other people, I mean, I found this myself even about Anyanla Van Sant, that her work didn't speak to me as much as it did to other black women I knew, because I did feel that it was all focused on self in a way that didn't, you know, doesn't have words like patriarchy or white supremacy and things that actually make people uncomfortable. I mean, we could do an analysis of Oprah's magazine as an example, where you have all kind of self-help strategies, many of which might be useful, but never linked to any kind of critique of dominator culture.